Welcome to Moniker, the Histories and Mysteries of Names, the podcast that loves high literature, so long as it has insanely depressing undertones. Every fall, I love to reread Anna Karenina. The first time I read it, it was about 5 years ago during October, so I guess it's just kind of become a ritual. Either that, or I've just been chasing that high I got from having read such a, brainiac book. Who knows? Either way, it's become kind of a marker of the seasons in my life, like how other people remember to swap out their snow tires. By the way, quick side note, if you're wondering what happened to part two of Emma, it is coming. I needed a little bit of a break. And what better way to take a break than to dive into the most hard to penetrate literature of the Western canon, right? Sometimes I just don't make good choices. Formidable or not, I think the hardest part about reading Anna Karenina, or any Tolstoy for that matter, is keeping track of all the names and titles. Each of the characters has five different names that are used interchangeably. Like Konstantin Levin, he's alternately called Levin, Kostya, Konstantin, and other things I'm sure I'm forgetting. But anyway, it's very confusing. Now, Tolstoy didn't get to be Tolstoy for lack of depth. Our boy knew his stuff, so I'm absolutely certain that the use of names by different people in different settings is a powerful storytelling tool in his tool belt, communicating things like familiarity, deference, etc. However, I haven't studied all the nuances of the book in any academic way or Tolstoy's methods, so that's not the rabbit hole we will descend into today. What I'm really curious about today is the use of the terms prince and princess in Russian literary works like Karenina. The first time I read Anna Karenina, I was like, Princess Shcherbatsky. Oh, okay, she must be the daughter of the Tsar because the Tsar is like the king. But then dozens of other princesses and princes start entering the narrative, and I'm like, wait a minute, there's no way this is just one massive family. So they can't all be royalty. I eventually gathered from the context clues that the use of prince and princess was way different than our traditional Western use of the terms. The princes and princesses in Karenina are members of the aristocracy, but they're not related to the Tsar in any way. At least not that I remember. This made me pose the question to myself, why were these nobles called princes and princesses when it seemingly would have been easier to just call them dukes, duchesses, earls, etc.? And what was the timeline of this mistranslation? Was it when the major Russian authors like Tolstoy were being translated into English? Or did it have something to do with Peter the Great's obsession with France? Well, if these questions are going to be answered and our lust for knowledge satisfied, we're gonna need us a hypothesis.
Hear ye, we shall now read the hypothesis!
Thank you, Squire. As with all our episodes, this is the part where I form a hypothesis on our naming question before doing the research. It's not the most scientific thing in the world, but it's a good place to start for an internet search. So I know that Peter the Great was freaking obsessed with France, and he wanted St. Petersburg to be like Versailles. So it's possible that cosmopolitan nobles started to kind of self-style as princes and princesses to keep up with the French wave of fashion in the court. And since Tolstoy was really into social commentary, I don't think he would have made mistakes in the rankings of his characters, so the use of the terms probably didn't start with his works. Plus, people translating his works would have been really conscientious about getting it right because they would be very literary-minded people themselves. So the misnomer probably wouldn't come from there either. So I think my hypothesis will be that Russian nobles were called princesses and princes because it was a way for them to associate themselves with the French and other cosmopolitan empires of Europe. Now let's dive into the research and see if I'm right. or if these are the desperate ramblings of a madwoman, or both. The use of prince to describe a governor, overseer, ruler, or magistrate, essentially our Western understanding, can be traced back to around 1200 AD. The word comes from the Old French word prince, which itself is rooted in the Latin term principis. Principis was basically an adjective form of the noun meaning something like that which is first or he who goes first. This is also where we get terms like principal, like the principal dancer in a ballet. One of the first people to hold the official title of prince was Edward II, whose father bestowed the title Prince of Wales upon him in 1307 after he conquered Wales and killed the last native prince. This was the beginning of the long-standing tradition of that title being given by the king to the heir to the English throne. Prince Charles holds the title of Prince of Wales to this day. By the way, if Edward II sounds familiar, he's the guy we met in the Mortimer episode who was overthrown by Roger de Mortimer and Isabella the She-Wolf of France. Ugh, so cool. Despite some high-profile usage, prince and princess in use as the son of a monarch or heir apparent wasn't widespread until the mid-1500s. It was around this time that princess, being a feminization, according to the conventions of Old French, came into use. In the early 1600s, prince and princess started to be applied to all offspring of a monarch, regardless of their place in the line of succession. It's like how Prince Harry is still a prince, even though he's like seventh in the line of succession. So princes and princesses made the journey through Old French to Middle English to Modern English. This took place in what is now the United Kingdom, France, Spain, and other major European monarchies who used Romance languages or just Latin-based words that may have been borrowed words. Meanwhile, across the Baltic Sea, a group of fractured mini-states were girding their collective loins to break the shackles of the Mongolian Golden Horde to become an empire to rival the great European powers of its time. Come with me as we cross the muddy waters of the Danube, hop over the snowy Carpathian peaks into the mysterious Land of the Rus. The history of the Russian Empire doesn't really start in earnest until the reign of Peter the Great, but let's get a little context to the period leading up to the unification of Russia. Russia's beginnings as a nation are very complex and difficult to nail down. Most historians consider the creation of the Rus and Kiev states in the decades preceding the first millennium as flashpoints in the country's development. These states were founded by Scandinavian and Slavic people groups who migrated from the northwest and south to found cities in what are now Poland, Lithuania, Ukraine, Belarus, and of course, Russia. According to legend, the Land of the Rus was supposedly founded by Scandinavian Prince Rurik when he settled in Novgorod in the 9th century. By the way, I'm going to slip into the Borish and Natasha accent. I'm really sorry. I'll do my best. Novgorod was in the north, stretching from modern-day Finland to the northern Ural Mountains. Rurik was the founder of the Rurik dynasty, whose scions would rule the area until the mid-16th century. Proto-Russian princes began expanding southward into what is now Ukraine and founded the Principality of Kiev after expelling Proto-Hungarian tribes. Kiev became a prosperous center of trade that the princes sought to legitimize through the adoption of Orthodox Christianity. According to another legendary, probably apocryphal origin story, Prince Vladimir of Kiev sent an emissary to the leaders of the main faith groups of the 10th century to examine the beliefs of each. This was ostensibly so he could decide what state religion would jibe best with the culture of what was now being called the Kievan Rus. Vladimir allegedly rejected Islam because they don't drink alcohol, which he said was, quote, the joy of the Russian, end quote. I mean, seriously, same. and he rejected Judaism because it was a dispersed religion without a state. In reality, Vladimir was probably motivated by political considerations, as the Byzantine Empire was crazy powerful and like right next door. The Kievan Rus was overthrown in the early Middle Ages by the invading Mongols and remained under their control until the early 1300s. The vast holdings of the Mongols' Golden Horde included 9 Russian principalities and stretched from the Black Sea to the west to almost as far as Lake Baikal in the east. The early Russians started a refuge from the western cities being harassed by the Tatars to a little fortress city called Moscow. Ever heard of it? Being at the headwaters of 4 major rivers, Moscow's strategic and trading advantages helped it to rise in prominence kind of under the radar of the Golden Horde. While the Mongols and the emerging Ottomans were conquering the surrounding regions, Moscow managed to emerge from this time relatively not burnt down and destroyed. Moscow's prosperity launched the period of the Muscovite princes who, over the next few centuries, would expand their territory and make Moscow the spiritual center of the Russian states. Under Grand Prince Vladimir, Moscow became a permanent principality of the Kievan Federation. The lesser princes under Vladimir kind of seemed like they were almost like mobsters in a way. In his book, Russia, A Short History, author Abraham Asher writes, quote, "As junior princes, they could not even aspire to the throne of a major principality and therefore devoted all their energies to expanding their patrimony, generally by the most expedient means. They were crafty opportunists." End quote. The reason why these were lesser princes appears to be because the ruler of the Kievan Rus, or Kievan Federation, was known as the Grand Prince, like how we were talking about Vladimir was the Grand Prince. I wasn't able to find an exact answer as to why the leader was called the Grand Prince instead of a king. I would think they would style themselves as kings or emperors, but at any rate, here are a few possible answers to that question, as far as I could tell from the research. 1. King is a Germanic term that wasn't broadly in use as denoting high-powered monarchs until the late 14th century. 2. The term king isn't magic. Just because the Rus had a grand prince didn't necessarily mean that that was a lesser ruler, like with our Western understanding of the term. And 3. The Kievan Rus, being part of the Eastern Orthodox Church, was spiritually and politically subject to the Byzantine Empire, and perhaps that devotion extended to the freedom to use certain royal titles. It also makes sense that these would be princes because they ruled principalities, and so the Grand Prince would be over the other princes, so Supreme Prince, Grand Prince. Something really interesting that I found from the etymology, the old Slavic and Russian words that are translated as prince come from the same Germanic roots as the English word for king. They both come from the Proto-Germanic kuningas, which denotes someone who is superior in a class of people. It was often used for tribal chieftains in Scandinavia and like Anglian tribes. The words themselves, king and prince, just went on diverging paths from the same root, one through Finnish and Slavic and the other through Norse and Saxon. So while kings and princes have different connotations to us, they share a common ancestor. So their differences are actually pretty arbitrary. Man, sometimes I think my brain's gonna break. In 1462, Columbus didn't yet sail the ocean blue, but Ivan III came into power in Moscow. He was responsible for greatly expanding the Grand Duchy of Moscow, a little bit by diplomacy and a little bit lot by force. You should definitely read more about his rule if you get the chance. He was very interesting in his dealings with people. A lot of blindings. although he did finally help the region shake off the yoke of the dregs of the Golden Horde of the Mongols in 1480, so that was in his favor. Ivan styled himself in official documents as the Tsar of all the Rus, and due to his marriage to a Byzantine princess, considered himself the natural successor to the Byzantine emperors. Prior to Ivan's efforts to unify Russia, a lot of the power in the principalities was held by different ranks of aristocracy, with lots of clannish infighting. You can see how the seeds of autocracy are being sown. In 1547, Ivan the Terrible crowned himself the first Tsar and autocrat of all the Russias in the Cathedral of the Assumption in the Kremlin. Seriously, what's a greater power move than setting up your own coronation? This is another episode, if you will, that historians point to in the origin of the Russian Empire. While Ivan III was called the Gatherer of Russian Lands, Ivan IV, his successor, is generally accepted as the country's first Tsar, and not just because he called himself that. There's a lot of debate about whether Ivan IV or Ivan the Terrible was in fact terrible, or if that's just revisionist history courtesy of Western schools of enlightenment. He was probably in good company with his contemporaries as far as brutality is concerned. We soft-handed moderns tend to frown on things like burning people's beards off and scalding them with hot brandy, but for them, that was just Wednesday. Historian Jeffrey Hosking seems to put the results of Ivan's reign in pretty concise terms. In his book Russia and the Russians, A History, great book by the way, he writes, quote, "What he, Ivan, set in motion was not state building, but the statization of personal dominance. Thus was launched in the peculiarly Russian style of government, a huge, diverse, vulnerable empire resting on personalized power broking." End quote. During Ivan's and subsequent Tsar's reigns, the Russian princes are still in existence. They just seem to be part of a broader structure of aristocracy that includes other noble ranks. The addition of thousands of acres of lands from Ivan's military conquests meant that the Tsar could grant land holdings to people of noble birth and also just people he liked. Princes would be in charge of what were essentially mini fiefdoms, with layers and layers of administrative bureaucracy to manage them. It makes sense that they would feel regal and princely when you consider that the amounts of land and people they were in charge of were mind-boggling. We can assume that they also retained the titles from the principalities, despite the more universal rule of the Tsar. It seems like the system was on some level similar to when countries have been under the rule of the Holy Roman Empire, but have still had their own kings and government, like we learned about in the Bohemian episode. Russia experienced extreme turmoil in the late 16th and early 17th centuries. Those years were marked by war, famine, and aggression from neighboring powers. Most of this was due to the ruling powers failing to have clear lines of succession. Ivan the Terrible really screwed everyone over, particularly his son, when he murdered his heir during one of his violent rages. In 1613, a council of nobles in Moscow elected Mikhail Romanov as the next Tsar. This was the beginning of the Romanov dynasty that would rule the country through the fall of the empire in 1917. One of the more unfortunate side effects of this dynasty was the almost immediate implementation of serfdom. This policy condemned the peasants, about 80% of the population at this time, to lives of indentured servitude on noble-owned lands. They were owned by the nobles and were unable to move freely or leave their lords' estates. In 1689, Peter the Great ascended the Tsar's throne and became the first Tsar to travel to Europe. Peter traveled to the major powers of Western Europe in the hopes of forging alliances against the Ottomans, who were always a looming threat. He also wanted to bring back the latest technology and ideological advancements of the day. Peter was dismayed to find that Western Europe viewed Russia as being really backwards and barbarian. And for all intents and purposes, they weren't wrong. Compared to the splendor of France or Spain, Russia looked like a medieval relic of the feudal age. When he returned home, Peter was inspired to bring Russia, quote, from darkness to light, end quote. And he implemented tons of reforms designed to Europeanize Russia. When the Russians gained territory in the far northwest from the Swedes, Peter constructed the highly advanced and highly French city, St. Petersburg. Apparently named after St. Peter and not Peter the Great, but I'm sure that was just a huge coincidence. A cosmopolitan city being built on a marsh was a great feat of engineering. Unfortunately, the elaborate city cost hundreds of serfs their lives during the years of construction. In perhaps the most college kid who studied abroad and is now insufferable move, Peter initiated reforms that required people to adopt more European dress and mannerisms. He even imposed a tax on people who refused to shave their beards. This wasn't received well among some of the Russians, particularly the very Orthodox. I can't imagine being asked to forgo my fur-lined robes for silk breeches and a dumb tri-corner hat in the cruel Russian winters, and to lose my cozy warm beard too? Forget it. The adoption of French as the language of the Russian court was a much easier sell for Peter the Great. In just a few decades, Russian was relegated to everyday speech and the lower classes, while French was being taught to the elites and used in all manners of the state. It became a powerful social signifier for Russians wanting to distinguish themselves as European rather than Asiatic. In the book, The French Language in Russia, the author writes, quote, French then became a sign of social status, an important marker of social identity. Speaking and writing in French went hand in hand with other signs of noble habitus, and French was the language bound up with pursuits such as salon culture, dancing at balls, card playing, and musical life. End quote. Sounds a lot like the court of Marie Antoinette or something. The author also talks about how the Russian elites who adopted French fancied themselves to be part of a, quote, transcontinental class, end quote, that didn't really ascribe to any overt national identity. We should note that this wasn't just taking place in Russia. With Latin's retirement from official use, French became the international language of the European rulers and their courts. It's where we get the term lingua franca. So while Russia was attempting to Europeanize, it was also just following the tide of the continent at large. Where Russia's transition to French gets interesting for our topic of prince and princesses is that, as we've previously established, the words prince and princess come from Old French. It seems like Russian nobles, in translating their rank, may have chosen the impressive sounding and arguably semantically identical translation of knyaz, which is the Russian word for prince. Most of the princes would still at least have land holdings in their historical principality, so why not go with that translation? Especially since the French were already using dauphin to specify the heir apparent, so there probably wouldn't be much confusion in calling someone a prince. Unfortunately, I haven't found any primary sources explicitly spelling this out, so a lot of this is just conjecture. Russia continued its trajectory to modern power through the reigns of monarchs like Catherine the Great and Alexander II. It seems like Russia really arrived on the international stage when she was able to defeat the French in the Napoleonic Wars of the late 18th and early 19th centuries. And when I say Russia defeated the French, I'm referring to how the climate and terrain defeated the French. Now, I know that's not the whole story, but you can't deny what an asset Russia's frigid, unforgiving winters can be. It's a lesson Hitler would learn years later. Like Wallace Shawn says in Princess Bride, never start a land war in Asia! Inconceivable. Obviously, I'm skipping over some parts of Russian history because I want to make sure that we give proper time to the Imperial Russia of Tolstoy's time. Tolstoy's best-known works were written during the tumultuous Great Cultural Awakening of Russia. In the 1860s, Tsar Alexander II abolished the practice of serfdom. This was a good thing, but as with most well-intended legislation, it had some unintended consequences that placed more burdens on the people it sought to help, such as the fact that the lands were subdivided into really small parcels so that each family of peasants had their own land, but it was really hard to grow enough crops on such small plots. Plus, they were under like this really ridiculous tax burden, and grain imports from abroad raised the prices of food, etc. Suffice it to say, times was hard, and the act didn't necessarily make things any better. Just to give you a feel of the time, it should be noted that as a result of the French Revolution, Russia was being flooded with French expats who brought their progressive humanist ideals to widespread consciousness. And then, of course, there was the failed overthrow of the Tsar by the Decembrists, great band, who opposed the autocracy. All this to say, Tolstoy came of age as a writer in a time of rapid social change. For some reason, it makes me think of Arthur Miller when he wrote The Crucible during the Red Scare. Maybe that's not related. In Tolstoy's works themselves, we see how the members of the aristocracy live in an insular, alternate reality. Their world often doesn't make logical sense, but that just shows how fragile and arbitrary it is. This is exemplified in the titles of Prince and Princess. In War and Peace and Anna Karenina, it's suggested that the social hierarchy is being jumbled. Characters who we know as princes, like Oblonsky in Anna Karenina, are shown to be living above their means and kind of coasting on their good names, like Rose and her mom in Titanic. Alternatively, a character like Count Vronsky, who is a count, enjoys privilege in the military, but he still has to serve in the military. That's probably how his family rose to distinction in the first place. Due to the tenuous hold the elites have on their privilege in these books, they perform little gatekeeping behaviors that separate them from the commoners. Characters will frequently switch to French when they don't want their servants to overhear what they're saying, or they'll talk about something like, where are the most fashionable places to dine, and then badmouth people who don't eat there. It's very us against them. These conventions were true to Tolstoy's day, but it's interesting how they serve as great literary devices. The use of the terms prince and princess helps show how disconnected the characters with those titles are from reality. Prince is an ancient title of mythic properties, so much so that it's almost as archaic and irrelevant as someone being called a chieftain. Tolstoy shows that this title offers flimsy protection for the characters against the unpleasantness of reality, and how inept they are when the characters are actually confronted with reality. Titles can't keep you warm, especially pretend ones. Tolstoy is clearly critical of the frivolity of the upper classes, suffice it to say. In order to be sure that Tolstoy wasn't the origin point for the use of prince and princess in describing Russian nobility, I did a little research on the process of translating Anna Karenina into English. I thought that if Tolstoy had intended to use the French word prince, it would be written in the Cyrillic as a borrowed word, instead of its Russian equivalent, kind of like how we use Roman characters to write Chinese words. Interestingly, in comparing the text in its original Russian to the English translation, courtesy of my husband, man of a thousand hobbies, the word prince isn't a borrowed word from the French. The text reads knyaz, which means prince or ruler, but it comes from the Proto-Germanic with the same semantic translation as we learned earlier. So I think we can comfortably say that the use of prince and princess for Russian nobles was not a Tolstoy invention. Well, what a crazy sleigh ride through the Slavic night that was. I wish I had time to do a more thorough analysis of Tolstoy's work, but, I mean, we could be here for days, honestly. But it's very clear that he was critical of the aristocracy of his time, and If you read Anna Karenina, he very closely identified with the character of Konstantin Levin, who is somebody who comes from the aristocracy, just like Tolstoy did, but he's critical of it, and he sees the merits of a simpler life that isn't bound by all of these really arbitrary and superficial social customs that, in his mind, pervert morality. The question didn't produce a super satisfying answer as far as the use of prince and princess for Russian nobles, but let's see if I can sum up what we've learned. Russia began as a loose confederation of principalities that were ruled by princes. The princes were called knyaz in Russian from the Proto-Germanic word kiningaz, which meant king or ruler, also the common ancestor for the English word king. The princes retained their titles through centuries of political and social upheaval, which consolidated and divided their holdings by turns. Following the unification of Russia and its desire to become a European power, the knyaz were francized, if that's a word, to princes in the style of the time, and to reflect the fashion. In the remaining years of the Russian Empire, the princes and princesses gradually lost power and influence, culminating in the 1917 revolution, which just brought down the whole apple cart. And just a little epilogue here, the revolution of 1917 didn't actually destroy all the lines of Russian princes and princesses. There are several people today who would be princes and princesses by birthright if the empire was still in existence. I'll include an article on them in the show notes because it's really quite fascinating. One of them is like a socialite in London who puts on a debutante ball every year. It's crazy stuff. Well, I think we have done our best today, my friends. Thank you so much for joining me today on Moniker, the Histories and Mysteries of Names. If you have a name you'd like featured on the podcast, or you just really need to scold me for my ham-fisted history of a major European power, please email me at monikerpod@gmail.com. Until next time, farewell!